BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the historian Professor Margaret Macmillan. She's known for her perceptive analysis of events and for her ability to assess the way they are shaped both by the historical forces of the time and by the individuals who participate in them. As for her own history, it might have been a childhood spent in Canada, hearing stories about family connections all over the British Empire that first kindled her interest in her chosen subject. It's equally possible that playing with a First World War hand grenade, a souvenir of her grandfather's, put her on the path to becoming a military historian. She spent 25 years as a teacher before she wrote her first book, and it was her second, published in 2001, that would be her breakthrough. Her account of the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 became a bestseller, and she became the first woman to win the Samuel Johnson Prize for non-fiction. Decorated many times over, both in the UK and Canada, in the past year alone, she's received the Simons Medal in recognition of her exceptional contribution to Canadian life and delivered the 2018 Wreath Lectures on Radio 4, exploring war's place in human culture. She says, "History can help you make sense of your present situation, to remind you that there were other situations like it in the past, and to help you ask the right questions. It may help you, like a sign on the road that says, dangerous curve ahead, and makes you drive more carefully." Professor Margaret Macmillan, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
So I mentioned your prize-winning book, Peacemakers, about the Paris Peace Conference of 1919. Now, its success must have been all the more pleasing because, surprisingly, it was rejected, wasn't it, by a number of publishers?
Quite a few. I have a file somewhere I found the other day, and I was quite amused to read them. I mean, one said, nobody wants to read about a bunch of dead white men sitting around a table talking about peace treaties. And another said, which was from quite a well-to-do university press, said, we can't afford to publish a book that only a few people will buy.
So why did they get it so wrong, do you think? And what was it about the book that connected with people?
I think why publishers perhaps got it wrong is it was at the end of the Cold War and everyone was looking ahead. And the Paris Peace Conference seemed so far in the past and why worry about it? But as the troubles began after the Cold War ended, you know, we all thought there was going to be this lovely moment of peace. And then suddenly Yugoslavia fell to pieces. You got troubles in the Middle East, trouble in Afghanistan. And people began to ask, how did this all start? And why are these places having these conflicts? And you have to go back to understand them. To understand the Middle East conflicts, you have to go back. And so I think my book came at a time when people were beginning to ask those questions.
And just to check, how many copies has it sold now?
I've never done a final top, but well over 500,000.
So it worked out well in the end. And you were asked to rename your book for the American market because apparently books with the word peace on the cover don't sell so well. Why is that?
It came out in the UK in 2001 and it was coming out in the US in 2002. So that's after September the 11th. And the Americans were in an angry mood. And my editor in New York said, look, peacekeeping is not something they want to think about at the moment. And she said, also, Americans love Paris. And so they renamed it Paris 1919. And actually, I think it was a good move.
Tell us about your first piece today. Why have you chosen it? And what are we going to hear?
Well, the first piece is a Welsh ballad, Myfanwy. And it's partly because my mother was Welsh. She had a wonderful voice and she adored Welsh music. And whenever a Welsh choir came to Toronto, where I grew up, we always went. And as children, we went sometimes to North Wales to see my grandmother. And there was always music then. And my father, who was Scots and who, of course, loved the bagpipes, did also love Welsh music. And this was his favourite Welsh song, as well as one of my mother's. So it's one that has particular sort of memories for me.
Cheer on, O Avon, O
Mavanwi, composed by Joseph Parry with words by Richard Davies and performed by the Morriston Orpheus Choir. A track that represents your connection to your Welsh family, Margaret Macmillan, and your book Paris 1919 did that too. You are the great-granddaughter of David Lloyd George, the Liberal Prime Minister who was at that Paris conference. What had you been told about him when you were growing up?
I was told by my grandmother and my great aunt, who I was very fond of, and by various uncles and aunts and my mother's, you know, that he was a great political figure, and they took on all his sort of enmities. He'd had quarrels with the generals. They thought the generals were wrong. And so they were partisan, of course. And then I started studying history seriously, and I think I became a bit more detached, as one does. And I think I used to slightly annoy the elder generation by saying I don't think he was perfect in every way, which you do when you're young. And then when I started doing research for the Paris Peace Conference book, I approached it, I think, with a very objective and skeptical mind. But I did come around to thinking, yes, he had his faults, but he was a great negotiator. And he was someone who wanted to try and get the different sides together, which I think is a great talent in a statesman. So I developed an admiration for him, which I hadn't had before as I was doing the book.
You've written extensively about the First World War, and you've said that being Canadian has benefited you in that process. Why?
Well, I come from a small country, not small geographically, but small in terms of power and population. And I never felt when I was writing about great events like the First World War that I had to defend my country or blame my country. I mean, I think it's more difficult if you're German or British or American because your countries were so important in these conflicts. And I think you're under more pressure to take a stand. And I felt being a Canadian, I could be somewhat detached and simply try and look at all sides. I don't know if I succeeded, but I think coming from a small power actually has a certain advantage.
And your writing career took off after many years spent teaching. I wonder how your teaching experiences shaped you as a writer.
I think it was hugely important. I taught at a polytechnic where none of the students were doing history as their main subject. They had to do liberal arts electives. And so they sometimes did it very reluctantly. You know, they were doing engineering or business, and they thought it much more important to concentrate on their core subjects. And so I learnt, I think, through that 25 years, and we did a lot of teaching. I learned to tell stories. I learned to get them interested. Not everybody, I couldn't, but I think I did learn to be a better teacher. And if you learn to tell a story, then it also helps your writing.
Let's go to the music. What's next?
Well, this is music that comes from the Second World War and was very much part of, as when I was growing up. I mean, I grew up just after the Second World War, and so it was still part of what we listened to. It's Duke Ellington. And it's Mood Indigo, which is so wonderful. And, you know, I've always had the greatest admiration for him. He was a wonderful musician. He was a great band leader. He was so dignified. You know, he dealt with American racism, and he just kept this wonderful dignity. My parents were both medical students at the University of Toronto in the 1940s during the war, and they danced to this at the medical students' graduation with Duke Ellington's band. I know, and I think it meant a lot to them, and we heard it as children. And then one of my brothers graduated from an American university, Princeton, I guess the 1970s, and my parents went down for the graduation, and there was Duke Ellington's band, and so they danced again. It's lovely music, and I remember it very fondly.
And Mood Indigo, a favourite of your parents, Margaret Macmillan. So tell me a little bit more about your life growing up. You were born in Toronto and you're the eldest of five children, I think. How did you all get along?
Not always well. I mean, we were a bit like, Europe before the First World War, shifting alliances. So, sometimes my sister and I would fight, and then sometimes my sister and my eldest brother would fight, and then sometimes the three of us would get on and we'd gang up against the youngest two, but I'm devoted to them all. I mean, over the years, we became very good friends and we still see each other a lot. And I'm very lucky in that.
I have to ask you about the hand grenade that I mentioned in the introduction. Yeah. It was a family heirloom of sorts, I think.
Yeah, my Canadian grandfather was a doctor as well, and he'd gone with a group of Canadian doctors in the First World War to fight, initially with the British Army, because there was no Canadian Corps at that point. And he brought back souvenirs, including a hand grenade, and my grandmother used to keep it. I mean, those days people had things called curio cabinets, which were little sort of gold things, and you had little souvenirs from your trips or whatever. And the hand grenade was in it, and we'd take it out and roll it around the floor. And at one point, I think when I was getting interested in military history, I said to them, you know, the pin is still in it. And there was a sort of consultation among the elders, and the hand grenade was removed because I think it may have still been live.
Oh, my God. Where is it now? Do we know?
Well, we don't, unfortunately. My father buried it up in the country. My parents had a farm outside Toronto, and he buried it. We have no idea where he buried it. So we're just hoping no one puts a spade in.
So tell me more about your mother. What sort of person was she?
She was a terrific mother. She died only about, I think, 3 years ago, and we all still miss her. She was very lively. She was very vivacious. She was unlike a lot of the other mothers in the neighborhood. And that, you know, they were nice, but she was much more fun. And some of my friends still say, you were so lucky. You know, she just was fun. And she encouraged us to read, and she encouraged us to play. And all the other houses in Toronto was very sedate in those days, and every house had a best front room. It was the best parlor, and you never went into it. I mean, people covered the furniture with plastic and tablecloths and things. Mm. And our living room was a living room, and we could turn the furniture upside down and make forts, and we all sat there and read. It was the only house on the street that was like that.
Time to go to the music. Yeah. Tell me about your third disc today. Why have you chosen this one?
One of the things I love is opera, and I love Verdi. And this is that famous duet from La Traviata, where the father of Violetta's lover comes to her and says, look, the Baron comes to her and says, look, for the sake of my son, you have to leave him, and for the sake of our daughter, who will never make a respectable marriage. And it is beautiful. And she does renounce her lover. And you can see that the Baron is beginning to understand who she is and what sort of woman she is. And it's just, I find it incredibly moving.
Ardite al Giovine from Verdi's La Traviata, sung by Elena Kotrubash and Cheryl Milnes with the Bavarian State Orchestra, conducted by Carlos Kleiber.
Margaret McMillan, your father, a doctor, was on board a naval ship during World War II when he got wind of your birth from a newspaper, I think. What happened?
He was somewhere off Gibraltar. His ship was helping do convoys across the Atlantic. And he got a semaphore signal from another ship saying, congratulations, you're a father. And he apparently signaled back saying, what sex? And the semaphore on the other ship said, don't know. And there'd just simply been an item in the newspapers that Lloyd George had had his first great-grandchild. Mm. And so that was me. But my father didn't meet me till I was 2 years old.
And did your father talk to you about his war experiences?
He didn't talk much. He told us funny stories as children. He would tell us very funny stories about, you know, being in Gibraltar and all that, you know, sort of walking along La Linea into Spain. And so he'd tell us funny stories. But only once, we were all together as a family, and we were all quite grown up. And he just, for some reason, started telling us about the time his ship was nearly sunk. And he got quite sort of emotional, and then we all got worried about him and didn't want him to be so, you know, we sort of all patted him on the back. But it was the only time he talked about the sort of terrors of war. Mm. And I do remember it very vividly.
Your parents sound like extremely can-do people. I wonder how much of their sense of adventure rubbed off on you and your siblings.
The great pattern in Toronto and most Canadian cities was to have a summer cottage. then you'd go north and you'd spend the whole summer at the cottage. And my father hated it. He just hated cottages. He thought they were boring. He said there was nothing to do. And so he and my parents just put us in a car, five of us. I don't know how they stood it. We drove. We drove to the West Coast. We drove to the East Coast. We went hiking. We went on canoe trips. You know, canoe trips are quite strenuous. We went on canoe trips for 2 weeks where you had to carry everything over portages and paddle. But none of us have ever bought a summer cottage or wanted one.
You're going to be fine on this island, I think, Margaret.
Well, I hope so. I wasn't ever very good at the campfire stuff, so I'm going to have to brush up, I think.
Time for some more music. It's your fourth disc.
Well, it's Canadian. That's why I've chosen it. We haven't had a very violent history in Canada, but we had two rebellions in the 1830s and 1837. And a number of the people who led those rebellions were sent into exile, both English and French speakers. And this is a song in French about some of those exiles sung by an English Canadian folk singer, which I think shows something, I hope, about the way our two cultures meld. But it says something to me about all those Canadians who are either forced to leave or do leave. And you always miss Canada, and you miss the space, and you miss the country. And every time I hear it, I think about Canada.
Bonnie Dobson, Une Canadienne Errant. Margaret McMillan, you began studying history at the University of Toronto in 1962. Had the 60s started to swing at that point? Were they swinging for you?
No, not really. When I went to the University of Toronto, it was very proper. I mean, we didn't wear trousers. We wore skirts. We wore little cardigans. Men wore ties. It was extraordinary. But it happened when I was at university. You began to hear about this, you know, something called marijuana, which people were talking about. It all sort of began to happen. And music. And it was a time of considerable turmoil. I mean, in Canada, we were a much more calmer society. But even there, we were affected by what was going on in the US. And the American consulate was conveniently very close to the University of Toronto. So between lectures, we'd go down and demonstrate for civil rights.
Your PhD thesis was titled The Social and Political Attitudes of the British in India. Why did you choose that subject?
I suppose growing up in Canada, you cannot but be interested in the British Empire because we were part of it. And, you know, when we were growing up, our passports were British passports. Everywhere you had the pictures of the monarch. And I became very interested in the gradual change of the British Empire into the British Commonwealth and the independence of the different countries. And India also because my maternal grandfather was a doctor in India. And we had as children a tiger skin that he had shot a tiger. But anyway, in those days, it was okay. And we used to play with the tiger skin. And my mother had been born there. So maybe I sort of learnt something through that. And it gave me a year in India, which was fabulous.
Yes, researching your thesis in the pre-internet era. What did that involve?
In a way, I think we were lucky, although it was much more difficult. I mean, there was no photocopying in those days. You had to go and look at the documents and take notes by hand. And you had to go to wherever they were. And nowadays, I notice with my graduate students is they will often go somewhere for a week and take lots of photos and then come home. But I'm not sure you get the sense of a place in the same way as if you have to live there. And what made a difference to me, I was writing about the British in India. And before I went, I thought, you know, they were pretty awful. And the women were pretty awful. And they were so intolerant. And they really didn't like living in India. And they complained about it. And then when I was there, I thought, you know, I can understand how homesick you get. You're a minority in a very, very different culture, very alien culture. And I remember one night being incredibly homesick, and I think I had something called dengue fever, which didn't help. And I thought, I just want to be home, eating the food I know with people I know. And I was listening to my radio. I had a little shortwave radio, and suddenly I heard this Mozart horn concerto on my little radio. It made me feel incredibly homesick. Thank you.
part of the rondo from Mozart's Horn Concerto No. 2 in E flat major, performed by Dennis Brain and the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Margaret McMillan, how do you feel about the task that awaits the historians of the future, the people who'll be combing through the mass of digital information to make sense of our own age and look for insights?
I don't know what they're going to do, because there's going to be too much, I think, and too little. I mean, there's going to be endless amounts of email and Twitter, assuming it survives. And I think a lot of governments are now storing it, so that maybe it will survive. But I think what's happening, and it's partly WikiLeaks, I think, and the other sort of big spills of data, that people are getting very cautious about what they say. And so governments and government officials aren't putting down on paper or in electronic form what they really think. And that, I think, is going to be a real problem, because what we do when we look at the past, particularly sort of 19th century, is we can read things that people wrote, and they wrote them knowing that nobody else was going to see what they wrote except for about three other people. So they're very frank, and I think it's going to be difficult.
So that shareability has shifted things.
I think so. I mean, I even wonder if people are keeping diaries as much anymore.
Do you still enjoy seeing research materials and actually being in contact with something that puts you in touching distance of the past?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember the first time I was reading something before the First World War, and there was sort of comments scribbled on the side and then the initials WC. And I thought, who's W? And I thought, Winston Churchill, you know, and you thought he just scribbled something hastily on this. And that is exciting.
What were you reading?
It was documents, something to do with naval strategy, I think, because he was very much engaged in that, because he was the First Lord of the Admiralty. But even physical objects, seeing something that someone once held. I remember an exhibition once that had Peter the Great's boots, and they were huge. You know, you just thought, who was this man?
We're going to go to the music now. Yeah. It's your sixth disc today. Why have you chosen this one?
Bob Dylan, Blowing in the Wind. Well, again, that's part of my youth. And perhaps you remember these things from when you're younger very vividly. And it was the 60s. And Vietnam was something that was a big cause. A lot of Canadians opposed it. We had our own demonstrations, being very Canadian, quite polite demonstrations on the whole. And this was a song that just wove its way, as a lot of Bob Dylan's music did through the 60s. And it seemed to... It wasn't just about Vietnam. It was about the turmoil, the upheaval, the civil rights movements, the whole sort of challenge to what had been an accepted structure.
How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
This is so wonderful.
Bob Dylan and Blowing in the Wind. Margaret McMillan, in your recent book, History's People, you look at leadership and you discuss in detail Joseph Stalin, Margaret Thatcher, Adolf Hitler and Woodrow Wilson. How often does what you find out about a person during the research process surprise you, and how often do you change your opinion of someone?
I think I'm often surprised. You find out things about people's private tastes, about what they're really interested in. Woodrow Wilson, for example, I found out told terrible jokes. And that sort of gave me a different view of him. You know, someone with a tin ear for jokes, it says something, I think. Or you find out that, you know, Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary before the First World War, had a passion for bird watching. And I think the only book he wrote was about bird watching. And that gives you a dimension. I can't say that it makes you think about them totally differently. I mean, Hitler was a vegetarian and nice to dogs. It didn't change my view of him.
And how possible is it to look beyond the public face that a person presents, particularly, you know, an iconic world leader, and find a real person? And how important is it to do that?
Well, I think it is very important. I think we're all at base driven by our emotions and our passions and our fears and our wants. And of course, we have intellectual ideas as well. And we think things through because we're rational beings. But I think we are a bundle. And I think great leaders are just as much a bundle of emotions and ideas and everything else as the rest of us. You can almost revere them too much and see them as sort of plaster saints or plaster monsters, or see them as not really being fully human. And of course they are, and they're driven by the same sorts of things as the rest of us, perhaps on a bigger scale.
And you've described history as more a branch of literature than of science, but it often has very real world effects. Can history books influence leaders to change their policy decisions, for example?
They can, I think. The trouble is, of course, if leaders read selectively. I mean, Bill Clinton apparently read a book about Yugoslavia and the Balkans when the whole place was blowing apart, which argued that the Balkans have always been trouble, they've always been like that, they've always fought each other. And I think that helped to persuade him not to get involved, which I don't think was necessarily a good thing. Kennedy had read Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August just before the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he was very conscious, and I'm glad he was, that you can sometimes blunder into catastrophic situations without meaning to.
And having studied the personalities of past leaders and the way that their individual character traits changed and shaped the course of history, what do you make of the current crop of world leaders?
It is interesting, isn't it? I mean, I don't want to be too pessimistic, but it seems to me we're in a rather difficult time where there are very few world leaders who inspire, at least in me, much confidence. Trump is clearly totally incompetent, I think way beyond his depth. I mean, he wasn't a great real estate developer in New York, and he doesn't have any of the qualities, in my view, that you need for president. I think we have also seen, a failure of political leadership in a number of countries. Perhaps I don't want to be rude about Britain, but the sort of drift in the past few years strikes me as something very, very unfortunate. And we've seen a rise of authoritarian leaders who aren't necessarily great leaders, but who have a particular way of running and manipulating their country. So individual leaders don't make the difference for everything, and the times matter and the economic forces matter and all that matters. But I do think individuals can, for better or worse, push history in one direction or another.
You said you don't want to be pessimistic. Where are the bright spots?
Well, Canada. I'm patriotic, but no, I mean, I think
those one-arm press-ups are pretty
strong. Good. But yeah. No, I mean, I think there are bright spots, and I think democracy is strongly rooted in ways that it wasn't perhaps in the 1930s in some countries. I mean, who would have thought, you know, in the 1930s, who would have thought that Germany would become the great bulwark of democracy and a liberal international order?
Time for some more music. What are we going to hear next?
Well, this is from a composer I came to late in life, Wagner. I didn't get Wagner when I was younger. I found it heavy. I don't know what I thought it, but I was influenced by Wagner's own appalling views on many things, including his anti-Semitism. But as I began to listen to Wagner, and I began to listen to the ones that are perhaps more accessible, like The Flying Dutchman and The Meistersinger, I began to get it, I think. And I finally went to a Ring Cycle, and I did it sort of in a week, and I found the music just kept going on and on through my head. And so now I'm not a Wagner fanatic, but I'm much closer to that end of the spectrum than I was. And so this is the overture from The Meistersinger, which is one of the first Wagner operas I really came to love.
The overture from Wagner's Die Meistersinger von Nürnberg, performed by the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Maris Janssens. Margaret McMillan, we've talked a bit about the past. I would like to ask you about the present as well. Some commentators believe that institutions like the UN and the EU, which were set up to maintain peace, seem quite vulnerable in today's climate. And you started your Ruth lecture series with the ominous phrase, "We have a lot to be pessimistic about." How worried are you about where we are now and what comes next?
Well, I don't want to be worried, and I think pessimism is something you slip into too easily, and I certainly don't want to be cynical about what's happening. But I am more concerned than I would have been, say, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. I think it's partly because we are tending to forget, with the passage of time, it's inevitable, why we wanted a United Nations, why we wanted the things like the World Bank, the Bretton Woods organizations, the World Bank, the IMF, World Trade Organization, why the European Union seemed like a good idea to European countries who'd been at war with each other so much. And I think we forget that these institutions came at a time when the world was shattered in a very bad way, and have proved, you know, of course they have faults, and you know, I'm not defending everything they do or have done, but they came at a time when people wanted something that would guarantee stability and peace, which is not such a bad thing to want. And I think we're now contemptuous of them. We don't understand their purpose. And I think we have the United States, which is becoming increasingly isolationist, at least under the present president. And if the United States is not engaged, then it's really bad for all of us. And so yeah, I am worried. And I'm worried about the growth of illiberalism. I'm worried about the growing hostility in so many countries to immigrants, this fear of others. I mean, I think these are not good signs.
You've also written that we've lost a sense of common ground. What do you mean by that?
Well, the way in which politics has become polarized in certain countries, that the people simply won't speak to each other. The more I go to the US these days, Republicans and Democrats are just not speaking. And quite often they're living in different suburbs or different bits of the cities or different parts of the country. And that's worrying because, you know, we do have common ground. We have to work together. You know, of course we can disagree, but at a certain level we want to make sure that our society works.
Let's go to the music. It's your eighth disc today. Tell me about this one.
Well, it's from The Rosenkavalier, which is another of my favorite operas, but it's from the last act when the Marshaline recognizes that Octavian is in love with a much younger woman and she's recognizing her age. And so it's about aging. And since I'm now 75, aging is something I think about, not all the time, but I'm aware of. And it's a very moving piece, I think, and it's sort of when the Rosenkavalier stops being a comic opera and it becomes something rather sadder. Anyway, it's elegiac, and it is, I think, a wonderful piece of music.
The trio from Act 3 of Der Rosenkavalier, with Sophie Koch, René Fleming and Diana Damerau. They were accompanied by the Munich Philharmonic, conducted by Christian Thielemann. It's time to cast you away to our desert island, Margaret McMillan. What do you think would present the biggest challenge to your survival while you're there?
I'm not actually that good at building things. And so I think, you know, I hope it's going to be a warm tropical island, because the idea that I can be, you know, Swiss Family Robinson and build a nice little commodious chalet, I don't think so.
How are you with solitude in your own company?
Not bad, actually. I think I spend a lot of time on my own, and writers do. I think after a few days, if I've been writing and I haven't talked to people, I think I'm getting a bit rusty at human interactions. I better get out and meet someone. But yeah, I'm not too bad.
Okay. I'm sending you away with the complete works of Shakespeare and the Bible. You can also choose a book of your own to take with you. What are you going to go for?
What I'd like to go for, but it may be slightly cheating, is Proust, À la recherche du temps perdu. And I would like to take it in French, because my French is rusty and it would force me to read in French and it would keep me going for quite a while.
Of course, you may have it. It's yours. You can also have a luxury to make life more comfortable. What would yours be?
Well, my luxury, I don't know if it exists in technology, but what I would like is something, possibly a device that will teach me to sing so that I can practice singing. It'll be good on a desert island because no one can hear me.
Now, buy a device to help you practice singing. What have you got any idea what that might be? What do you think?
No, well, I'm thinking of something, because I'm not allowed another book. Otherwise, I could take Singing for Dummies. But if there was something that would play a few notes and then I would sing back to the thing and it would play it back to me, I couldn't do anything else with it. It would just be for learning to sing.
Well, we'll have to invent that. But Margaret, if we can, we'll rustle one up and give it to you.
Yes. Oh, please, please. And I thought I could sit there and sing and not bother anyone, but maybe eventually the dolphins will come and sing to me too.
And finally, one last choice. Which of the eight discs that you've chosen today would you decide to save?
I think I might take Mood Indigo, because it was played all over the war in the Pacific in the Second World War, and I'd be on an island somewhere, and it might remind me of all those other people who came through.
Professor Margaret McMillan, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island Discs with us.
Well, you've made me want to get to the desert island. Thanks.
As we leave Margaret on her island reading Proust, there's just time for me to remind you that there are many historians in our back catalogue, including Sir Simon Sharma, Lady Antonia Fraser, and John Julius Norwich. In 1995, Sue Lawley spoke to Eric Hobsbawm, who recounted his childhood upbringing in Berlin during the early 1930s. After the death of both parents, he and his sister went to live with their aunt and uncle.
We were taken over by an aunt and an uncle. It so happened my father's brother had married my mother's sister, so there was a closer relationship between these uncles and aunts, and they more or less took us over and went on educating us and looking after us.
And this was in Berlin?
This was in Berlin.
Which, of course, was a historic time, early 30s.
It was an extraordinary period, absolutely extraordinary. I mean, these few years are, in many ways, the absolute crucial period, at least in my life. It was living through what we knew to be an extraordinary, dramatic turning point in history.
You knew then, even then?
Yes. We knew what the stakes were. I remember the afternoon when Hitler came to power, seeing the headline as myself and my sister were walking back from school. I was already politically organised in some kind of schoolboys' association, communist type.
Can you remember your reaction in that moment when you saw that headline?
The reaction was, what, if anything, could be done? And meetings, distributing leaflets, all the rest of it, didn't do much good.
And what do you remember of those months after Hitler came to power in January 33? How did things change?
As far as I myself was concerned, obviously they didn't change. We weren't affected by it. We were English. We were not German. Consequently, the worst that could conceivably have happened is being expelled. But as far as other people are concerned, we knew that in some ways this was the end and a terrible, dangerous period had begun. Otherwise, it so happened that my family left a few months after that, not for political reasons, because my old man's job folded in the Depression and went back to England to try and reconstruct his life there.
That was the summer of 33 and you would have been 16?
Not quite 16, yes.
The historian Eric Hobsbawm. And you can hear his edition and download many more programmes via the Desert Island Discs website. Join me next week when my guest will be the hairdresser Trevor Sorby.
Did you know that technology can make us kinder to one another? Did you hear about the diver who walked out of the sea onto a Portuguese beach, dragging the internet behind him? Did you realize that how you speak to the little robot helper in your house might cement age-old stereotypes for decades to come? I'm Alex Krotowski, and those are just some of the stories that we've looked at in The Digital Human, the podcast that explores what it means to be human in the digital age. If you want to hear more, and I guarantee we will surprise you, come check us out exclusively on BBC Sounds.